Welcome back. Will you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Please respect our speaker and silence your cell phones. Our speaker is being recorded with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, John from Mission Viejo.
Hey everybody, I'm Sean. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Mike for asking me to do this. And I want to thank my surprise visitors that came up tonight. So, let's see, my sobriety date is January 21st of 2000. I have a sponsor. He's sitting in the front row in that green shirt. He'll be speaking next week. My home group is the Tuesday night men's meeting in Leucadia. I do live in Mission Viejo. I moved up here a little bit over a year ago, but for the most part, majority of my sobriety has been down in North County, San Diego, Oceanside area. So I've never been to this meeting. Very cool. I especially like that you guys go smoke at the school grounds. I think that's a great tradition. So, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now, to the best of my ability. Let's see. I was born in Los Angeles, raised by a single mom. My mom had me when she was 17 years old, had a younger brother, and you know what? She did the best job she could with what she had at the time. My dad was a full-blown alcoholic, who actually is a member of these rooms now, but at the time, you know, I only have one memory of my parents being together, and it was an argument in the kitchen, and my dad ripping the phone out of the wall, and I thought, what a cool thing, how powerful he is. And that's my only memory of them being together. Other memories going up of my father is I know that the King of Beers was a big part of our life. We had a dog named Budweiser. I know that every time he picked me up, you know, he had an open container in the car. And I know when I went to visit him, you know, he was living with his parents, my grandparents, who died of this disease. It smelled of scotch and cigarettes. And so alcohol was around my life for a long time. The first time I got drunk, believe it or not, was in second grade. I was a latchkey kid. And for those of you who don't know, I'm sure you all do, you know, mom's single mom, two jobs. We had kids. We'd walk to we'd have keys. We'd walk to school. We'd walk home. And, you know, one day I was walking to school and I saw this pretty girl across the street. And so in second grade, I discovered girls too. She had a great suggestion. She decided, you know, why don't we just hang out here today instead of going to school? And that seemed like a great idea. And, you know, for 28 days, we ditched school straight. So during that time, I learned a few things. I learned about pornography, and we raided her dad's porno magazines. On the front, it was called Milkmaids, and there was all this white stuff, and I didn't know what it was. And I learned about alcohol, and I learned to drink. And, you know, we drank, and we got, it made us feel funny, and, you know, whatever. We just hung out. And needless to say, it, you know, finally caught up with me, and Mom found out we weren't going to school, and, you know, she changed that pretty quick. So, fast forward a little bit. When I was in middle school, we moved up to the Bay Area. We moved to San Mateo, Foster City, California, just south of San Francisco. And we moved away from all of my family, and in middle school, that's where drugs were introduced into my life, and I'm going to share a little bit about those outside issues. It is part of my story. You know, I find, and there are some young people in these meetings, but For me, it was easier when I was younger to score dope than it was to buy alcohol. And so that's what I did. I mean, I did alcohol whenever I could. We'd have parties at the house, and we'd sneak beers out of the refrigerator, and we'd put them under our bed, and when our parents were at school, we'd switch them out for the cold ones, and we'd drink them. But like I said, that's where that's where drugs were introduced to my life. And I was like a lot of other people. My experience was I had a hard time fitting in. In school you had like the preppy kids, and you had the jocks, and you had this plethora of different people. And the ones that stood out to me, and the ones that appealed to me, were gang members. And this is around the time the movie Colors came out, and that kind of tied two and two together. And I made a decision that those were the kids that I was going to hang out with. And before things started to get going with them, we had moved to San Diego. So we moved from a pretty diverse neighborhood to Del Mar, California, which is about as white as can be. And, I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't fit in. There was no diversity. They opened up a nightclub at the Del Mar racetrack. It was called On Track. And this was great. We used to go there on the weekends. And what it did is it brought people in from different parts. So I started to meet some people from Oceanside. And at that time, Oceanside was a pretty rough town. And I was introduced to some guys that hung out with the Bloods. And I started hanging out with them. And till I met some guys from Southeast San Diego that were way tougher than the guys from Oceanside. And then I started hanging out in Southeast San Diego. So they taught me a lot. You know, they taught me about Old English. They taught me about St. Ives. They taught me how to talk to girls. Taught me how to fight. Taught me how to sell dope. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun, actually, till it wasn't anymore. My junior year of high school, I was called into the principal's office, and principal called me in and sits me down. He says, "Sean, I'd like to talk to you about something." I said, "Okay." He goes, "Now I want you to be as honest as possible." I said, "Sure, no problem." I said, "Do you have a gun?" I said, "Yes, I do." I said, "Is it loaded?" I said, "Yes, it is." I said, "Can I have it?" And I said, "Sure." And I kind of broke down. And what was happening to that point in time, the guys I was hanging out with in Southeast San Diego weren't really getting along with the Chicano club gang that was at that school. And, it was fine when my friends were around, but I was getting my ass kicked, like, every single day at school. And it was fine if it was just one-on-one, but when it was a few on-one, I just got to the point where enough was enough. And so, this is pre-Columbine, this is pre-all of that. This is late 80s, early 90s. So, they sent me off to juvenile hall, and I went to jail for the first time. See, when I went to juvenile hall, I was there for a couple weeks, I was a little nervous at first, but once I got into it and got into the groove of things, it actually did more for my reputation on the street than it did to rehabilitate me and scare me into doing things different. And so I did my couple weeks, and I got out, and I went to juvenile court schools, and I was like, okay, all right, I'll just get back in the swing of things. And did well enough at juvenile court schools that they tried to reintroduce me back into the school system and try to get into regular high school. I did a summer school there, and they didn't want me. And I went to a continuation school called Sunset, which is in North County, San Diego. And I thought I had them fooled. I mean, I have a newspaper article still to this day about how I supposedly turned my life around and how I changed. And they were sending me to speak to, possible troubled youth. And what they didn't know that I was wired out of my mind every time I go and do these talks. And, I mean, I don't even know. I mean, I must have just talked and talked and talked and talked and talked. But my 18th birthday came along, and I got called into the principal's office once again. And he goes, Sean, happy birthday. And I go, thanks. He goes, now get the fuck out. He goes, you're 18 years old and I don't have to put up with your shit anymore. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, you're not fooling anybody. I know what you've been doing. I know what's going on. Get out. Go see your probation officer. Okay, well, I'm done with school. So I go see my probation officer, and he goes, happy birthday, you're no longer on probation. And of course, I tell him, I say, hey, you know, I'm like, it's because I'm doing a good job, right? You're letting me off. He goes, no. He goes, unfortunately, there's nothing else the juvenile institution can do for you that you'll be either locked up or you'll be dead within the next year. And he got one of those things right, because within a few months, I was looking at 19 years in prison for armed robbery. By this time, my drinking and using had progressed to, you know, that's all that mattered. I was working at a gas station. The guys at the gas station, there was a bunch of ex-cons, Hell's Angels, and some guys that said that they were in the Mexican Mafia. I don't know. I didn't, you know, I didn't double check it. But I worked, you know, I worked the graveyard shift, and I sold dope out of there, and I was wired, and, you know, I would drink, and I'd sleep in my truck during the day. I'd drive my truck to a park and sleep in that. One day, as the sun was coming up, I was sleeping out in front of that gas station, and my dad knocked on my window. And my dad lived up in L.A., and by this time he had been clean and sober, and I'd been to some rehabs, I'd been to some meetings, I'd been on a court card, you know, I just couldn't connect. You know, I came into these rooms, and a lot of the guys looked like Mike, and I was like, you know, 17 years old. No offense, Mike, but you and I would have nothing in common. I didn't connect, you know, and he goes, Sean, he goes, you know, I love you. And he goes, when you're done, there's a place you can come. My house is always open. And, I got to the point where I was just fucking exhausted. And, you know, needless to say, I still had this court case pending and whatnot, and, my attorney was recommending, hey, you know what, you need to be going to meetings, you need to get yourself cleaned up. And, you know, I went and saw him, and then I went into another rehab. And so going through the court cases, I had a choice to make. And it wasn't an easy choice. It was either live clean and sober or 19 years in prison. And you would think that to a normal person, that would be an easy decision to make. For most people, it would be, but for an alcoholic like me, it wasn't. And, you know, I ran it as long as I could. You know, I continued to, you know, I went to this rehab, and I decided I was going to get clean and sober, and I was following all the rules and the directions, and I was really going to give it a shot, and I was able to get, you know, enough away from it. And when I left that rehab, they told me that you're not going to stay clean and sober. We don't think that you're going to last a day. And, you know, I proved them wrong. I stayed over 5 years clean and sober. What a coincidence that my probationary period was 5 years. So, you know, I hung around these rooms for about 5 years on a court card. You know, I did the absolute bare minimum. I mean, I went to meetings. I said sorry, so my version of making amends, and then I tried to recruit my friends into getting sober with me so I'd have some people to hang out with, so that was my version of step 12, and had zero success in any of it other than, you know, staying dry for 5 years. So at this time I was married, I had a one-year-old daughter, and you know, I decided to take that drink, and this is where alcohol really became a part of my life. And, you know, I justified it every different way I could. You know, I said that, you know what, as long as I stay away from that other stuff, I'll be okay. You know, you're older now, you work, you're married, you have a kid. You know what? You have a long day at work, a man deserves to have a drink after work. And, you know what, I had that first drink. And one night we were going out, and we were in our 20s, and we were going into the L.A. scene, into the club scene at the time, my wife and I, and And I was always the designated driver, but that night I decided to take a couple shots of vodka as I was pouring those drinks in the kitchen. And you know what? The walls didn't fall down, and I didn't lose everything, and nothing happened. But just kind of like a sense of relief, really. So it progressively got worse for me. You know, she didn't know I was drinking for a while. Till one night, you know, we'd go to the club and I had my little routine. And as soon as I got to the club, I have to go to the bathroom and I'd get lost in the crowd and I'd go to the bar and I'd order a couple shots. Until one night she tapped on my shoulder and I turn around and it's her, and I turn around, the bartender's handing me shots, and I turn around and it's her. And I'm like, those aren't my fucking drinks. So we had the talk that night. She never saw me drink up until that point. So we had the talk. And, man, I sold her a bill of goods, and she bought it 100%. I said, you know, when I was a kid, you know, drugs and this and that and blah, 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 whatever. I said, okay, well, only if you drink when we go out, or only if you drink if we have people over. So needless to say, I tried to go out or have people over as often as possible. So toward the end, what happened is... we had gotten separated. I did like every good alcoholic did. I wanted to go out and drink that night. She didn't want me to go out and drink that night, so I got into an argument with her. And I said, I'm leaving. She said, no, this time we're leaving. And she left. And what happened at that point is it opened up the floodgates for me. It really did. I mean, just there was no one there to monitor anything I was doing. And it was on. I mean, it was absolutely on. And within a few months, it spiraled and spiraled and spiraled to the point where I was getting evicted from my apartment. I basically called up my dope dealer and I said, come to my house, I'm getting evicted. Take anything you want for an 8-ball. And I sold him, you know, whatever he wanted and left the rest. I ended up living out in this apartment out in Escondido. And it was a really toxic environment. There was a lot of drinking and using going on there. And at that time, was right around this time, you know, almost 13 years ago, I hadn't seen or talked to my daughter in months. And, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about my pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So I was living into this apartment. I had a bedroom right next to my bedroom. There was a kitty litter box, so it reeked. The master bathroom, like, toilet was clogged up. I had this mattress that had no box spring, but it was on a frame, and it just kind of bowed in the middle. And it was Halloween, right before I got sober. And, you know, my wife didn't ask much of me. You know, in fact, she didn't ask me for money. I would hit her up for money whenever possible. I never paid anything to have her help. With my daughter or child support or anything like that. And she's like, you know, I don't ask much, but I want you to come take her trick-or-treating. And I came and picked her up, and we went to the mall, and we must have got through that mall in record time because I was just in so much pain and needed to get out of there and needed to get well. So there was that. And then right before Christmas, you know, I hadn't seen her from Halloween till Christmas, and I knew I was going to see her. And I had all this time to go out and buy a gift for her. And, you know, when your priorities are other than, you know, your child or real life stuff, you know, here I was on Christmas Eve at a CVS or whatever it was called then. I had $20 to my name. And I had a really hard time. It's like, do I spend my last $20 on this gift for my little girl? Or do I spend this $20 on whatever else, alcohol and drugs? So I bought her this car knowing I was going to see her. The next couple weeks went like that. You know, the millennium came and went, Y2K came and went. To my disappointment, the world didn't end year 2000 like I was hoping. You know, I drug it on to the bitter end. And those last couple weeks, you know, I can tell you that I was done long before I was done. Every day was kind of the same thing. You know, it was, tomorrow's going to be different. Tomorrow you're going to get up. and you're going to shower, you're going to go to work, and you're going to come straight home, and you're going to sleep it off. And I get up in the morning, and I was so weak that I couldn't get from the bed to the shower without putting a stimulant in me. And I couldn't get from the shower to dress without doing some more. And I couldn't get to the door without doing some more. And I definitely couldn't get through the day without it. And then as soon as 6 o'clock rolled around, people would come up and say, "Hey, you know what, let's go have a drink." I say, "No, not tonight. I'm not going to have a drink. I'm just going to go home." "Come on, just have one." "Okay, I'll just have one." But it was never just one. One would turn into closing the bar down. And then I'd get home, and I'd lay in bed, and I'd wonder, how the hell did I get here again? And tomorrow's going to be different. Tomorrow I'm not going to do the same thing. And it went on like that for weeks. It got to the point where, you know, I was getting sick, that I went to a hospital. I was up in L.A. one time, and I was driving back, and I stopped at my dad's house, and I'm like, "You got to take me to the emergency room." And he's just laughing, because he knew, and I just couldn't get that IV in me quick enough. So as soon as I got well, I went back to doing what I was doing, and my last drink was January 20th of 2000, and it was about this much of vodka. I was at my buddy's house, and we were getting ready to do it again, and I was like, "I need to have a drink. Let's have a drink." And he's like, "Well, this is what I have." So he poured it, and I drank it. He's like, "Well, we can go get some more." And at that moment, I said, "You know what? I'm going to go get some." And I never came back. I never talked to that guy again. What I did is I picked up the phone and I called my wife and I said, "Hey, I need some help and I need to talk to you. And I need to explain to you what's been going on." And luckily, she picked up the phone and she happened to be up in L.A. at the time. And I explained to her what was going on. And I'd been to enough rehabs and I'd been to enough AA meetings to know that I didn't need to do that again. That the solution that I needed was right here. So I slept on our couch for 3 days and got my ass to some meetings. I went to the Alano Club in Oceanside, and thank God, for me, there was more to AA than what was going on at the club at the time. And some guys introduced me to some other meetings. And then some guy named Mike started dragging me around, and he took me to my home group. That's been my home group ever since. So, I will say for the first few years, I want to talk about sponsorship a little bit. And my first sponsor, John Broom, who died sober, so I'll share his name. John sponsored me for a few years. And at first it was really, really awkward. I mean, John was, late 60s. I was like 26, 27, 28. And, he was just a very kind, gentle man. And he listened to me, and I started calling him, and we started to go through the steps. And, we stopped working the steps at about 6 and 7. As far as John was concerned, we had passed 6 and 7, and I was on to my amends now. But internally and up here, I couldn't wrap my head around 6 and 7. And so John passed away, and it shattered me. I mean, it rocked my world. Not only from just him dying, but I was living in these defects of character that was causing so much turmoil in my life that I didn't realize it. And my current temporary sponsor, Victor, came up to me one night after the Tuesday night meeting, and he said, "Hey, you know what? I know, you don't have a sponsor right now. Why don't I be your temporary sponsor until you find one?" And I said, "Okay." And, he really saved my ass. Knowing Victor, I've heard Victor at meetings, and I always liked what he had to share, but I would sit in those meetings and I would say, "That guy's never going to sponsor me. He's too tough." And, once again, I was so wrong. And so it got to the point bad enough where I called Victor one day and I said, "Hey, you know what? So this time I had a few years sobriety, and I knew for me to drink or to use again wasn't an option. but I was in so much pain that I just wanted to fucking die. I mean, I was just done. And he met me at Denny's. I actually have pictures of Denny's to remind me of what that was like and hitting a bottom in sobriety. And every time I see one, it helps me remember. And luckily, they're like everywhere. So Victor met me at Denny's. I had eggs. He had oatmeal. And we started to meet on a weekly basis. And one week he said to me, you know, why don't you meet me at my house? I'd never been to his house. And, you know, it was kind of uncomfortable for me. And so I went and I met at his house. And he pulled out this packet and he said, why don't we work the steps? I know you worked the steps with John, but why don't we work the steps together and see what happens? And you know what? The bottom of my heart, I knew that it wasn't going to work. I knew that nothing was going to change. And he said, well, why don't we just try it and see what happens? And for the first time in my life, I had gotten completely honest with somebody. And I said, okay. I said, I'm going to do it. But if things don't change when we're done, that's it. I'm checking out. I'm like, I'm just fucking nuts. And so we started to meet once a week. And with this person, I have completely told him everything about me, holding nothing back. And, you know, he continued to accept me. You know, he never shunned me. He never not took my call. You know, and I had to go into it that way. I mean, I really had to go into it with, you know what, this is me, take me or leave me. I got nothing to lose at this point. And I just had a desperation of, you know, of a dying man. And we got through the steps really slowly. It took a couple years. I was in no hurry to get through the steps. For me, it wasn't, you know, because if I would have got through too quick and I didn't see changes in my life, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. And so we went through and we met on a weekly basis and we read through the 12 and 12 and we did line by line. And if we got to a line that I didn't understand, we'd read it again and we'd talk about it. And some weeks we'd get through two paragraphs and some weeks we'd get through no paragraphs depending on what was going on with me. But what it did for me is it created some consistency in my life and it began to open a door to where I can begin to trust somebody and be completely open and honest about what was going on with me in my life. And we got to 6 and 7, which, man, I love. In the book, it talks about in 6 and 7 to go to a quiet place, you know, looking at, you know, our assets and liabilities, what we just went through, basically our fourth and fifth step. And we turn it over, basically. And for me, I couldn't, that wasn't enough. That wasn't enough for me. And so when we got to the inventory, we did it a little bit different. And he had me write down a list of assets and liabilities. Some good things about me, some not so good things about me that I don't like. Some things that was causing me pain and then things that would make me feel good. And in doing that, I would really say 4, 5, 6, and 7 kind of rolled in together for me. Is because I walked away with that and understanding what the things that were, what actions and behaviors I was taking in my life that was causing me so much pain, that was causing me that emotional hangover. You know, I was doing some things that, you know, in sobriety that, you know what, if it wasn't alcohol, maybe it was sex, or maybe it was food, or maybe it was shopping, or maybe it was gambling, or maybe it was something, you know, that was just substituted with something else. And then, you know, there was some underlying issues that was causing me to want to escape. And, you know, I had to get to the root of that. And so for me, 6 and 7 is really an action step. And, you know, if I'm doing this that's causing me pain, I've got to do the opposite to not have that pain. And those slowly went away. And I think that, you know, in the 12 and 12, it talks about, you know, taking the same approach to this step as you would, you did with your alcoholism and taking the same actions and behaviors. And I've done that. what it's like today. How much time do I have? 10 minutes? What it's like today. Wow. When I look at the total net gains in my life, it is unbelievable compared to where it once was. I know some of the people that take birthdays today, happy birthday to all you guys, and I'm humbled by the amount of sobriety you guys have and where you are in your life, and we really want to welcome the newcomers. What it's like today is, you know, there's ups and downs, and I will tell you that this week has probably been one of the most trying weeks of my sobriety. Of my own making. It's always of my own making. So, you know, we got into the ninth step, and I would say about 98% of my ninth step is done. And you know what? Life is good. I'm seeing in color. Everything's good. My life is so much better than it ever was. And I would have been fine living the rest of my life with that 98% done. And, you know, they say God will do for you what you're not willing to do for yourself. And God has a different plan for me. And that popped up this week. And it's going to take a while. It's some wreckage I created in my life, some financial wreckage. And it's taken me years to get that. And you know what? It's just my turn. They just want their money. So they're going to get it slowly, as slow as I can. But for the most part, I can tell you that that you know my life is amazing. I work in an industry that I truly love. I work in the fashion industry. I get to travel a lot, which I really love. In this past year, I've been able to apply the same principles that worked for me when I was new, still work today. And about a year ago, I moved from San Diego. I moved away from my foundation, these guys here and this guy here. And I moved up to Orange County. And, you know, I didn't know anybody. And I thought about, and it was suggested to me, was, you know, what are some of the things you did when you were new? And when I was new, I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I got a commitment at a speaker meeting being a greeter. So thank you for the greeter. You know, got some commitments and was of service. And, you know, for sure my life absolutely changed. And I went from feeling like I was an outsider to definitely somebody that's been here for years. Now, most of the meetings I go to is north of here. So now that I know where you guys are, I'll definitely come in and visit. But even with work and travel, you know, in this past year, I've had the great opportunity to go up to the Bay Area. And I got to pretty much live up there every other week. And I went and I took a ride by that middle school. And it looked so much bigger when you were young, you know, and drive through those same streets of kind of where it all started. And, you know, I had the opportunity to go to some great meetings up there. Now, if you would have told me when I was new or even when I had a few years of sobriety that I'm traveling to San Francisco on business and I'm going to meetings and I'm going to like it, I would have told you you're fucking nuts. But it was amazing. You know, I went in there and I applied the same principles and I went to these meetings and I found the secretary and I made sure to shake their hand every single week and, you know, tried to help clean up and whatnot. And those little actions and behaviors, what those have done for me has made me feel part of and make me feel that, you know, this is my home, whether it's in this room or in the Bay Area or wherever. And if you're new, you know, I want to encourage you to do the same thing. You know, I want to encourage you to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. If you're going to 90 meetings in 90 days and you don't feel different or a part of after those 90 days, you know, you can always leave. You can always leave. The liquor stores aren't closing down. The dope dealer's not going out of business. And if he does, then there's another one picking up where he is or she. So I know some of you are out here. I want to encourage you to keep coming back no matter what. You know, that was given to me when I was new, you know, when I was 17 years old and I came into these rooms and you guys were so nice to me. A bunch of people looked like Mike were so nice to me. And it said, keep coming back no matter what. That we'll gladly refund your misery. you know, and they were right, and they did refund it many, many times. And it's still there for me today if I want to go back. But as I walk through, you know, the challenges of life, you know, I've got these tools and I've got these proven actions that I've taken that have helped me walk through so many other things. And it, as long as I can stay close and remember to apply those same actions, you know, things are going to get better. So, again, if you're new, keep coming back no matter what. If you're at this meeting and you're loaded, keep coming back. If after you leave the meeting, you're going to go get drunk or loaded, keep coming back. You know, keep coming back. You're always welcome. You guys always welcomed me, and that's it. Thanks.